Welcome once again to Food Conversations, Season 2. Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Once again on our show, we have two guests from Fresh Valley Farms, the owner-operators of Fresh Valley Farms, Steve Meggett and Annalise Group Cavers. Welcome, Steve and Annalise.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having us again.
Delighted to have you on the show again. Now, in our previous show, we talked at considerable length about the typically circuitous path that led the two of you to, of course, to each other, but also to having a conversation that is ongoing about farming and how it can or cannot be done. And you're doing it in a particularly, I think, important way in terms of the 21st century. It's one thing to have a farm that is growing food for humans, that is both from animal sources and plant sources, but to grow it the way you grow it, I think, is exceptional. And we're going to talk about that today: how you grow your food, why you grow your food, and how you share it with other people, which of course is done in the usual way, with people coming and giving you pieces of paper with faces and numbers printed on it, and you hand them some food. Anyway, all humor aside, if that was indeed humorous, I want to talk now a little bit about what you actually do. Now, your Fresh Valley Farms website, which is beautiful, by the way. There's so many beautiful websites around these days, but the subject is beautiful, the images are beautiful, and the language and the description of your farm is beautiful as well. So I want to start with a sentence, the very first sentence from your website, and maybe we can parse it together, Steve, and have a little bit of a conversation about what all the terms mean. So the first sentence is this: the farm uses all natural regenerative systems with an emphasis on animal welfare. Steve and Annalise are committed to being responsible stewards of the lands, fostering biodiversity and extensive habitats throughout the farm. Okay, farm. Let's start with farm. Why don't you outline the layout of your farm? It's in two parts, and it's got a house, and it's got some trees, and it's got some hillside, and it's got some flat grassland. But why don't you describe it? Paint a picture of what your farm looks like.
Sure, go ahead.
So Steve's family, I think we touched on this last week, that Steve's parents and grandparents live on one quarter section, and that quarter section has been in the family for 99 years, 100 years next year.
Indeed.
So that is at one end of Mountain View Road. And as you mentioned, it is partly forested. So about one third of the quarter section, a quarter section is 160, typically 160 acres. These sections are both a little bit less than that, so closer to 150, with about just a rough approximation of about 50 acres of arable land on each quarter section.
Annalise, is that typical for land around where you are, that a lot of it is steep and forested and not entirely suitable for farming?
Well, either side of the valley, I mean, I think that's fairly common. You know, when the homesteaders broke these sections off, you know, they would have been looking at every parcel is going to have some amenities like a creek running through it. And, you know, and that seems to be the way these quarters were broken up. Each one has the creek and some forest and some farmable land, which I imagine was all forest at the time when they first did it.
But,
of course.
But some kind of, some lesser slope and then some greater slope. We're just right on the edge of the hillside, and then like behind us is crown land. So for just our side of the valley, yes, it's typical. But even I would say the other side of the valley, It's similar, but not, I don't think that it's not as steep, like the, it's more hills than mountains on the, I guess the west side of Armstrong and the west side of the valley.
So what do you have?
We're on the west.
I think that both of our properties are kind of rare in the fact that they have some ALR. So some, half of it is in the, within the ALR and half of it is with, is not within the ALR, which is kind of rare. Yeah. Sorry.
So how do you, how have you configured them? You got your land, you got some arable flat land. How have you configured it? I know Steve has done a little building.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, we try to build on as little of it as possible, really. Anything that's farmable,
yes,
we keep the buildings off of. That's like a pretty much a rule around here, you know. If it's not a slope, we don't build on it. So when we do build, we end up moving a fair bit of earth to, or bringing in a fair bit of gravel to like, to make flat terraces along the places where we want animal, not just buildings, but places where we're going to have winter holding areas for the cattle. They're definitely on our least useful land because we're on such a limited base here. So that's, you know, that around the home sites, there's quite a few sort of little terrace spots where we have our barns and our, you know, winter yards. And then really everything else is, you know, it's in a multi-use, the arable land is multi-use, cropland / pasture land. So we're always trying to either be cropping it like when we have to, or feeding it direct when that's the most, you know, the most sensible thing to do, really. So it's just as adaptable as we can be. The main goal. Yeah.
And Lise, what's your vision of what you see on your farm when you look out, say, from your kitchen window, or if you have a kitchen window, looks out?
Yeah, we do have a kitchen window that looks out perfectly at, over the farm. So on our kind of farmstead, or our, the quarter section that we live on and farm, we have a larger hay field. So the other farm has kind of more smaller sections of field that are split up by either, there are some kind of veins of gravel on that farm that are way bigger than over here, like they'll have huge boulders, just really not arable land. Here we have a larger swath. So looking out of our kitchen window, we see kind of a 40 acre hay field with a smaller, some sort of different shapes. It's not a perfect square. And then behind us, we have what has been a garden right behind the house. It has been a garden for quite a few years. And last year I planted about 4,000 garlic there. And we had actually a friend who's an organic farmer as well, planted some milling corn. So looking out, we can see the winterized poultry shelters with their tarps off and a few different things. And in the summer, we would look out the window and see either occasionally a couple times, Steve cutting hay on that field. We saw the chicken houses moving across the field as well as the turkey shelters later on in the season. And then we saw the last thing was the cows going right across that hay field and grazing right to the last bit of grass. And
which is not something we're entirely proud of, because usually we like to leave a bit on the field, but this year's been a little bit stressed. So it's we took every last bit of grass we could, because hay is now at about $400 a ton. Yeah,
so let's talk a little bit about just that one thing, the heat dome and the drought conditions that applied this summer. What impact did that have on you guys?
I mean, the drought in general was the biggest impact. The heat dome itself, I mean, that affected mostly just some of our personal use, like crops like raspberries and cherries and stuff. But I mean, as far as, I don't know what it did to the forage production in particular, but you know, it was just the general lack of humidity and lack of moisture that just baked the moisture out of everything. And yeah, we couldn't get things growing again, really. It was nuts.
Just the recovery of plants.
Yeah, the heat dome, we actually did surprisingly well with the animals. We lost, basically lost 1 litter of piglets because she decided to have her piglets that day. Like it was 27,
yeah. It was
47 that day. Yeah.
So even with misters and like we could make a big wallow for a sow, but then there's a danger of the piglets drowning. Yeah. It's pretty much inevitable that they would drown. So. Sure. We just had to.
It was just. We had to cut your losses. It was not.
Yeah.
That was a really hard time for many people, and obviously, when you're growing things, it has an even greater impact because living things require an ecosystem that works for them, and this was not an ecosystem that worked for man nor beast, as they say. Yeah. So let's talk about a much more pleasant subject, and that is natural regenerative systems. Okay. Can you, one of you, Annalise, Steve, this is an open question. How would you describe a natural regenerative system? In 25 words or less.
Yeah, right. A natural regenerative system is something that sustains itself. I mean, without outside inputs. Like, it's something we hope doesn't deplete over time without outside fertilizer or in general it's even trying to avoid too much tillage or any kind of intervention. All we want to be doing is either cutting it with the tractor or managing exactly when the animals are on. This is for perennial crops I'm talking about. Now, I don't know much about how you can work annuals into that yet. It's a whole nother area that we're just not there yet. We hope to be someday.
But perennials are the basis of pasture, are they not? So, I mean, you're in a sense, you're just, and you're actually providing a little bit of fertilizer in the form of your animals producing excrement, which is fertilizer, I'm led to believe.
I mean, that gets into a very complicated subject. I mean, it's the animals, but it's also healthy plants and their exudates that are fertilizing the soil or building soil, really. Like I like to think of it as a big solar panel. Every field is a solar panel. And the more life you have on it and the more different diversity you have on it, the more sunlight you can collect, right? And that's why when we graze a pasture, we try not to take the grass right down to the ground so that there's still some of that solar panel there to collect the sunlight.
And so one of the principles there is that your animals move around. They don't stay in one spot and trample and compact the soil, right?
We use a lot of electric fencing. Like we're out there changing the electric fence like up to 3 times a day.
And your animals are very well adapted, I suspect, to the presence of a fence. They don't have to be told more than once.
Our rule is you keep it strong, at least to start. You keep it really strong and they learn and then they don't challenge it. They just don't.
Well, I'm sure I wouldn't challenge an electric fence after the first try myself. So I think they're right on the same page. Now, the next part of what you've got in your sentence is responsible stewards of the land. So to you, Steve, what does being a responsible steward of the land mean?
I think it's about sharing the habitat. I mean, I think that we're not here to dominate it and to kill everything and then start from some kind of vacuum or whatever you want to call that.
Replace it with your favored foods.
Yeah. We want to work in do something that works for us and for the wildlife around here and the insects and everything that creates a habitat.
And that leads to having inevitably multiple microhabitats, as it were, on your farm. Could you describe some of the different habitats that you have that you know are there because you've one way or another fostered their existence?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have Well, as like we already touched on, a lot of the land is forested. So, I mean, there's tons of wildlife around, like rabbits and deer, like the larger fauna. But then we have frogs, tons of frogs that we hear and see at night.
Because there's a lot of wetland. We should say
there's a lot of wetland around.
The way the creeks just spread out throughout the hillside everywhere, you get little pockets of water all over the place.
Yeah, and we've been really lucky. We've seen quite a variety of different owls in the last few years. We had a northern pygmy owl that we saw during the day, and then I think it was a year or two later, we heard it at night, every night through the winter. It was like, and then there was a barred owl that was here through one full winter. And we've seen great horned owls, like lots of bird life.
The forest here on our new place, we haven't really started putting the cattle in it much at all. And it's really a kind of a pristine young forest. Like it was logged 40 years ago.
Yeah. So it's replanted. It's not.
Well, it's naturally
reseeded.
But the variety of species on it probably isn't as great as it.
Yeah.
As it would have been.
But we really do appreciate it. And I do want, I mean, it's farmland. We're supposed to use it. So we have to put the cattle on it once in a while to get our farm status. So we will be working them into that more. But at this point, I really value it just as it is, right? Mm-hmm.
So you have four different kinds of animals officially. As well as all the wild animals, the owls and the pussycats. Do you have a pussycat?
We do. We have two cats pussycats. And one farm dog.
Then you fulfill the literary requirement for a farm.
For a farm,
So you have beef cattle, you have pigs, you have chickens, and you have turkeys.
Yeah.
So maybe just
we have broiler.
Beg pardon?
Yeah. We have broiler chickens.
Sure.
And then we have a few layer chickens just for kind of household use.
So each of them has their own particular habitat and their own structured universe. Why don't you just quickly run through, Steve or Annalise, through what they are.
So the cows obviously get the run of the place. We try to get them over every piece of land there is on our farm. But the chickens, they start off in the barn as chicks. For about 3 weeks, sometimes four if it's really cold out. Mm-hmm. And then we actually put them in a cattle trailer and haul them out to the field. And they're in an open walled tent when it's warm enough. Sometimes we put walls up, but most of the time it's a big open 18x40 tent that we drag along on the pasture every single day. We're moving that. So these chickens, they're on fresh grass every generally morning. So they're eating it. They're you should see the way they look for all the grasshoppers and stuff as we drag the pasture house.
They're very voracious, aren't they? When they get their minds made up.
Yeah. But they're just standard broiler white birds because that's what we have here. And they actually seem for the most part pretty well. I wouldn't say adapted to that life, but they get around a lot. They're not just sitting there like blobs. They're running around. It's pretty amazing to see that same animal that would just be pretty much sitting there in a chicken barn is just, you know,
constantly moving. Yes.
Yeah.
And around that tent is a lot, like multiple sets of electric net fencing. So it's an open walled tent, but they actually have a lot more, probably triple that amount of space that they could explore. They don't tend to venture too far from the tent,
it just depends how hot the sun is. I mean, it's time to go under and not be baking out in the sun or when it's raining, they go under, but they're spending a lot of time out there.
Yeah.
They've read the health reports. Exercise is good for you.
Yeah.
And then you have pigs.
Yeah. So the pigs, I've done probably the longest of anything. I think I had pigs before chickens, but I've had a sow. Like I started with one sow and she farrowed and I sold the meat. And then from then on, it's just been, you know, up to 12, 15 sows farrowing twice a year. that farrowing means having their piglets.
Yes. To those listeners who have not grown up on a farm.
We get talking farmer lingo and it's hard to understand sometimes.
Don't worry. I come from a profession that has more lingo than anybody else. Anyway, so they produce babies.
Yeah. And then the hogs, we keep them mostly in the forest. And then what we have had kind of a sacrificial 2 acre annual crop that we've had the pigs on for the last couple of years. This year didn't go so well because it's an annual crop and there was no rain and we don't have irrigation on that particular field.
And so, what annual crop actually was it? Can we reveal that to listeners?
Yeah, it's an Italian ryegrass was the base of that. And then we had like a couple types of forage brassica. So it basically looks like kale. And that was the dominant plant pretty well. So it was like they'd walk out, we'd give them a little strip of electric fence and they'd walk out and eat their salad for the day. And that's the ideal. We don't always manage to do that daily, but because it is a lot of work to do that kind of stuff with pigs.
And did the heat of and the drought of last summer have a big effect on the growth of that sort of forage crop?
No, it literally was a full failure. So we didn't grow it last year.
The exigencies of farming. It's not a smooth path all the time.
So we gave them a little bit more of the forest. Like we have a little chunk of forest that's kind of flat enough that I figure it could grow some grass once they're done with it. So we're kind of using them to break the shrubs that have grown up in that section. So that's where they've been most of this year, which is good. They had lots of shade and they enjoy it back there. They probably have 3 acres or so to run around on.
And then you have some turkeys.
Yeah, we had. Yeah. We have 2 batches of turkeys this year, and they're fairly similar to the way we produce the broiler chickens. They start in a brooder, and then once they're old enough, we let them straight directly out of the brooder, so they've got a big run around there while they're teenagers. And then once they're a little older, we just gradually move the net fencing until they can get out onto the field. And then from there, we just move another 18x40 tent around.
As you're describing this, I have an image of people who would love to live the way some of your animals are living, spending a lot of time outdoors, got shade if they need it, food is abundant.
I say that all the time. I go out to the chickens and I think, boy, they got it good out here.
They don't have to punch time clocks. They don't have to settle, some kind of schedule.
Yeah.
You also, if I understand correctly, because we talked about this a bit before the show, about selecting strains of each of these 4 species that are adapted to the kind of ecosystem that you raise them in, especially the cattle.
So, the chickens and turkeys are excluded from that because we just have the option of what we have in terms of ordering from hatcheries. But the pigs, I feel like Steve has done some fairly careful selection, although a lot of it is based on kind of temperament and personality. And
is that Steve's temperament and personality or the pig?
Yeah, maybe.
Honestly, if you ask me this, I say I'm not a breeder. Like we do a lot of things. And my goal is mainly to outsource breeding at this point because I'm just too busy. I can't focus on it the way I'd like to if I was trying to be a breeder. So like even with the pigs at this point, we're talking to a neighbor who is pretty interested in getting into doing the pig farrowing. So I'd like to be able to work with her to
make selections.
Yeah. But really we're not that good at breeding, but we do look for like a pig. We're looking for something with dark hair, you know, that helps because it doesn't burn. There's certain shapes we're looking for just because that produces, you know, more bacon or something. Yeah.
And temperament is important. If there's a pig who is particularly ornery or aggressive towards humans, we're not going to keep it around too long because it's just not that nice to work with.
And then with the beef, you know, my dad and grandpa have been running the beef cow-calf operation for so long that it's all about temperament, basically. I mean, we don't like animals to be too big, but really, yeah, when my grandpa was still doing it when he was 90 years old, we were looking for cows that would knock him over, you know, that's the main thing. So really, yes. Again, we're mostly looking at actually working with Dave Miege from Bastion Ranch. To be buying his calves because he's certified organic.
You know? Well, I can certainly say that Dave Miege gives you guys a very strong endorsement for what you're doing and the way you're doing it. So I think he's quite happy working with you. And I should, as a sidebar, add that collaboration and cooperation and sharing information is very much part of the whole regenerative movement and organic movement as well. It seems to be a basic principle from everybody I've talked to in the field. You don't sit in a corner and compete. You reach out and you share the burdens because there are significant burdens. You can't change the weather.
And I think that one thing to note is that we're not trying, like the basic principle isn't trying to industrialize it. Like you're not, and I think a lot of that kind of competition comes about when you have an industrial system, because it just encourages competition. That's
for sure.
A good thing.
The bane of capitalism, when it starts to get off the rails, which it seems to do quite quickly in many sectors, certainly the food sector, the aggrandizement of food operations has been a big problem. It's becoming a bigger problem. And the kind of work you're doing is really returning to the way agriculture and growing of food has been practiced for at least 10,000 years, and probably by our foraging ancestors, was sort of practiced in a little more informal way with food forests and with the fostering of conditions, you know, burning off the forest so that the buffalo could spread and that kind of thing. So it's something we've been doing for a long time rather than this kind of high-level industrial approach. So we have a picture of the farm, Fresh Valley Farms. Farms, that's plural, which is appropriate because there's two parts to it. Now let's talk a little bit about how you move out into the community beyond the farm. Because, as I was mentioning earlier, there's this inherent kind of spirit of collaboration, cooperation, and adaptation over time to what's going on in the world around you, and not just the weather, but the human community as well. So let's talk a little bit about something you said to me, Steve, when we were talking before the show. You said, I've always been a little bit political. Now, I suspect that Annalise has also been a little bit political. So here's two people, Steve and Annalise, who are a little bit political. So let's talk about where that has led. First of all, Steve, you've been involved with a couple of committees, the Agricultural Advisory Committee for both the Township of Spalanchine and the Regional District of the North Okanagan. Now, obviously, you didn't do that right away when you're setting up a farm, but obviously that's been happening for a while. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you got into that, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happened.
Well, when they're looking for a position for a young farmer who's willing to commit time to politics, there's two of us?
No.
Maybe three? No.
No.
Not a lot. But yeah, they have positions for young farmers, and that's pretty much, you know, I was a shoo-in. So they asked me if I wanted to join.
So you were approached by the regional district?
No, sorry, that was Spalanchine.
Spalanchine, okay.
And then the regional district, I was just interested in joining that one. I think I actually I wrote them and asked if I could join. Yeah.
And they welcomed you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure they welcome anybody who asks to join. I think it's a two-year term, but I don't think anybody ever leaves until they choose to.
Yes. Yeah. And so what happens in, let's start with Spalanchine. What sort of issues do you discuss at your meetings?
Well, I'm not really part of the Spalanchine one much anymore. Okay. I've kind of moved away.
You've graduated.
From that. But I think Mostly road use issues, spraying, bylaws about roadside spraying. What else? Lots of things. I mean, we kind of keep apprised of all the new regulations just so that we can disseminate that throughout the community.
Wildfire preparation.
It was great. Yeah, that was one thing I was involved with Spell Machine with a bit this year, was keeping up to date on how farmers are going to cope with the evacuations. And, you know, just making sure, even though, you know, there's an evacuation on, we have a way of getting, you know, I guess the right to come and deal with animals that can't be moved or shouldn't be moved in some cases. Like, you don't just move 1,000 head of dairy cattle, you know? So that's a really interesting conversation we're having at that level for sure. And there's, at this point, there's a lot of debriefing and talking about what happened last year too going on.
It's really affected people a lot. Probably a lot of people were scared. They really thought, my goodness, this is going to be the end of what we do.
Yeah, I think mostly the farmers they're not scared about the fire. They're more concerned about their animals and getting what they need for their animals. Because most of these places have a pretty good fire break between where there's, you know, going to actually be a threat of fire and where their operation is. And plus they have the resources to put out those fires too.
Yeah.
I think the main concern was that, you know, you need to get not just yourself, but your driver and your, you know, the feed truck and the milk truck and all those through. And there's not a simple system in place that can allow for that. So We're just figuring it out as we go.
And Annalise, you kept a connection with Kwantlen Polytech. It's funny, I always call it Kwantlen College, but its official name is Kwantlen Polytechnic University. I'm very impressed. Do they raise the fees when they change the name? I hope not.
A few years ago, I guess in 2017, 2018, I did a research project with them on institutional food systems in the Okanagan. So they were looking at trying to get more food into institutions here in the Okanagan, which now is actually a project not connected to KPU, but it's a project that Land to Table has worked on and quite successfully. From what I've heard, they have a really good relationship with UBC Okanagan. And anyways, so that was a really interesting project. I got to talk to people throughout the food system in the Okanagan and definitely learned a lot. It was fairly disheartening to just be brought abreast of all of the regulatory barriers between small and medium-sized farmers and lots of large swaths of the food system. So
Annalise, could you maybe pick a barrier? Pick a barrier and explain how it works as a barrier.
Right. I mean, there's two big main ones, one for fruit and veggies and one for sort of meats and livestock. The fruit and veggie side is there's a a regulatory kind of audit process called GAP, the Good Agricultural Practices. Okay. Is what that stands for. And so farmers or orchardists who want to sell to large customers wholesale, in basically if they want to use a food distributor, for example Sysco, they need to have this audit in place, and it's quite costly and it comes with added costs in terms of infrastructure. So just as a plain example, if someone is market gardening a couple of acres, they have a wash house that's a three-sided wash house with a big wash tub sink and a table for putting washed goods on, and it's gravel underneath, that wouldn't be acceptable according to GAP. It has to be a fully enclosed building from my understanding, and definitely it has to have a concrete slab. And so those things are quite costly.
For the paperwork too.
The paperwork is another issue, and then also the inspection itself. My understanding, I think it's in the hundreds of dollars anyway. So for a small producer, for a large producer who is doing one crop, for example, cherries or peaches, or huge amounts of salad greens. It's not a problem. You know, it's just a part of what they do. And it's touted for improving food safety, et cetera. But for a small producer, you have to have the audit done for each different product. So products that are treated differently would have different kind of plans and regulations. Yeah, so
it's very, you pulling your hair out if you have any.
Totally. So for those producers, and there are really supportive stores. So for example, Nature's Fair supports a lot of local producers. And I know it's not as kind of small or locally owned as it once was, but they have, from what I've heard from producers, maintained those relationships. So they still purchase from people, even though they don't have GAP, they just have a relationship with producers and they've sustained that. And that's really important to our local food system. And I, from my understanding, UBCO is doing the same.
Yeah, actually, it is. Even though Jimmy Patterson purchased it, I think he purchased it with an eye to a market that he doesn't normally serve, and that is exactly the market that you guys represent.
Right, and so there, that has a lot to do with their purchasers and the willingness of their purchasers to go that extra step, and the principles and values of the people who work there too. So that's really fantastic. But that does not extend to, for example, Interior Health Authority. They will not purchase, like, they're a huge institution, and I understand that there are lots of challenges in terms of coordinating with small producers, pickups, all those kinds of things, storage. There are lots of different logistics that make it complicated, but that is sort of a foundational barrier that doesn't allow apples from a 5-acre mixed orchard into that food system, even though they might be more delicious and potentially healthier.
Annalise, when you identify a barrier like this, and this is something that a lot of small farmers, I think, are addressing these days, you identify the barrier, you describe it to people who have regulatory powers or make policies. Is there a meaningful dialogue that goes on between you as a farmer, or the two of you as farmers, and these authorities who lay out rules, where you can say, look, it works for the big monoculture operation, but for a smaller, diversified operation, which is way healthier and much more adaptable to long-term solutions, it doesn't work well, and can we make some changes?
Both of those terms you just used aren't even in their dictionary. It's not. It's safety.
I would say that for us as a farm, we don't really enter into those conversations, partly because we don't have the volume to, like, that isn't the direction that we are moving in as a business. And as a researcher, I would say that there's definitely interest, but I would say it completely hinges on whether there's a champion within that part of the food system who really believes in those principles. And so the BYBC, I forget what the name was. It was a Ministry of Agriculture initiative, and they were promoting more purchasing among institutions. They wanted to get up to 30% of, like, BC food.
Right.
But the definition was quite broad, so it included things that were processed in BC, et cetera, et cetera. And changing the regulations, it wasn't kind of within the mandate of that project. So, I mean, I think that the case just needs to be further made, and hopefully people who are moving into the kind of dietetics and purchasing positions in Interior Health and other institutions as well start to value more the local food system, local food producers, the health that those foods can bring, because there are lots of opportunities for flexibility if that's the priority.
Well, if it's any consolation, I can share a little of your pain as a family physician. I have practiced small-scale minor surgery in my office for a couple of decades, and recently the college decided that safety had to be addressed in a more aggressive way. And so now, for a family physician to do that, there has to be a sterilization process that's just about like it is in a major hospital. And for a small producer of healthcare interventions like myself, that has meant that I no longer do those procedures in my office. I have to use either a large clinic or the hospital itself. It's a trend that's, I think, fear-driven and against science. I think it's a lack of scientific knowledge on the part of regulators. Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say it's not at all evidence-based. So there's very quickly, so that's sort of the picture for fruit and vegetable growers. But then in terms of meats, there's two different regulatory frameworks. One is the Canada Food Inspection Agency. One is the Ministry of Agriculture.
Right.
Ministry of Agriculture inspected meats can be sold only within British Columbia, whereas CFIA inspected meats can be sold throughout Canada. So there is lots of meat produced in BC, but Interior Health will only buy meat that is inspected at a CFIA inspected facility. And so that even excludes facilities like Farmcrest in Salmon Arm, which is a large producer of poultry.
Indeed.
And it's local to Salmon Arm, but it was only provincially. So it's possible that some of those regulations have changed in the last year, but there was a, I don't know, do I have time to carry on this point for a second?
Yes, you have infinite amounts of time to explain things within 1 hour. But the point that we're talking about, which is, I think, a highly significant point, is the presence of barriers that come out of past notions, out of uninformed decision-making, that kind of thing. So continue on that line that you were talking about, Annalise.
Here, we, processing is a major challenge for meat producers just across the board. And really, we only have access to the Ministry of Agriculture process or those inspected processors. There's added costs of being inspected by the CFIA. So those are the ones that we access. And again, like I said earlier, we're not really looking to wholesale our meats, but I'm sure that there are lots of people who would love to produce 400 chickens in a year and sell them all at once because they don't have the capacity or resources to market directly 400 chickens. So anyways, it's an interesting thing. I'll be interested to follow as regulations continue to evolve. And Steve was involved with the creation of the Small Scale Meat Producers Association, which has been really important in terms of advocating for small and medium scale meat producers like ourselves. They did a really large survey this past summer and are going through the results of that. And one of the members actually put in a Freedom of Information request for a report that was commissioned by the government and that actually states that there is no increased risk to on-farm slaughter as opposed to in an industrial setting. And that was not, it was not published. It was not made accessible.
Now. Yeah.
It is now public. So, and now they have also just started a new program that's called FarmGate Plus, where people can process a significantly more slaughter slaughter on their farm, significantly more animals than they were able to before.
Less limitations. Like we had the class D and E licensing system for places that didn't have access to abattoirs. But now anybody can actually apply for that. You can apply for the farm gate one, which allows for 5 animal units, 5,000 pounds live weight, I believe,
right.
Without even doing the feasibility study. And then if you want, or whatever they call that, it's some kind of, you have to look to see if you qualify for it because your needs aren't being met. So it's a big change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a slightly larger version of that, as I understand. It was announced in the local papers in August, where you can have 25,000 pounds.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. You do have to do a feasibility study of some sort for that one. Because if there's a really good abattoir right next door to you, you still could get denied if that abattoir actually has capacity for you.
Right.
But interesting.
But there isn't one in BC that actually probably has capacity for you right now. So.
Yeah, they're overbooked. Yeah. And there's also, for us as an organic farm, there aren't organic certified facilities. It's an added need that we have and that some other farmers have as well. So, yeah.
But then the other restriction that they lifted with that one is that you can sell outside of your regional district, which is a really big barrier. A lot of people who wanted to get their Class D license to do it prior to this would want to sell into a city that's nearby. But of course, that city is probably in a different regional district. So
yes, indeed.
Then it was kind of pointless.
And those aren't barriers that were affecting our farm. We didn't access those licenses. So we've always slaughtered and processed our meat in Class A facilities, which allows for meat to be cut and wrapped and sold anywhere within British Columbia. Mm. But those are barriers to lots of small and medium producers that we know. And it's also a barrier to kind of entry into the industry.
So let's talk about another barrier, which Steve and I, we discussed a little bit with reference to your work on the Agricultural Advisory Committee, and obviously in the regional district, that would be a main issue. And that is people who have an idea of different ways to use land from farming. In other words, the people who want to sell land so they can build infrastructure on it and make, as it turns out, because that's considered in our distorted system to be value-added land. When you've got infrastructure on it, they make more money out of it.
People are they're using it just as a representation of their wealth, and it keeps growing and growing, and people get, the people who own it get more and more. I mean, that is a problem.
And so you meet enthusiastic real estate agents sometimes in your work in the agricultural. It's interesting to be a real estate agent on an agricultural advisory committee, but there is, I understand. You're at one pole of land use where land is for its own value and the processes and outcomes of what goes on in the land are what you use and sell and make your living out of. And a real estate agent would see land as a flat surface on which to build something that would be sold for large sums of money. It could be a store, it could be an apartment block, it could be anything, but it wouldn't be for the land. So why don't you talk about that kind of dichotomy a little bit, Steve? Talk about that kind of, what kind of conversations that leads to.
Well, I mean, we in the committee, in the Regional Agriculture Advisory Committee, we review applications for exclusions and divisions of land within the agricultural land reserve. And I mean, we don't see all that many of them, to be honest. I don't know that we even, like, some of them may just go directly to higher levels. But we get to comment and vote on whether we want them passed. And a lot of them are, you know, they always look reasonable. I mean, you got a family, the parent or the mother wants, or father both want to retire on the land, so they want to build a second house. And I mean, it's always reasonable, but I try to step back and look at it from the, what do you call
like
that?
The long range.
Yeah, the 100-foot level.
The big picture.
And think, well, we can't do this every generation, or else, you know, I'll never be able to afford land to farm because there's going to be three or four houses on it. And you just, you know, I don't want to be in real estate. I don't want to be a landlord. I want to be a farmer. So, you know, from my perspective, I don't want more houses on land, period. I mean, it's just that simple. It's like, if it's farmland and you need more housing, then it can be mobile. it doesn't have to be permanent, and you can have strings attached to say it's for family. If the family's not there, it's not a rental. It doesn't sell with the property. It's for that use. And I mean, you know, and then of course it's appealing to us to have rental housing. It is to everybody, but you know, it's hard to make that argument because everybody looks at it from their own perspective. And you know, I'm looking at if my kids want a farm and there's another double the housing on all the farmland in BC, they will not be able to buy it. You know, it's, we're looking at some kind of weird serfdom where, and you know, old farmers, people who want land will have to rent it from people with way more wealth than them because,
So do you see that? So Steve, do you see that trend? I mean, it's been going on for a long time. The Agricultural Land Reserve, Agricultural Land Commission was created expressly. It doesn't always do its job, but it was created expressly to stop that process from taking place. If there's valuable farmland, then keep it as valuable farmland. Do you see that? And there's been times when the ALC was severely challenged by, you know, expansionist building pressures. Do you see that still happening as much now as, say, when you were growing up or when both of you were growing up? It's there in the background.
It sure seems like more to me. I mean, the ALC is being rejuvenated a little bit here, and they brought in some good rules, and then they rolled them back as far as I'm concerned. But it seems that just growth is just expanding exponentially. I mean, it's just the way it is. And we're in such a hot real estate zone here in the Okanagan that it sure seems to be encroaching on all of the farmland here.
It's not even, I mean, it's development, but it's also, I think, more noticeable is the speculation on land and the exodus of people coming from Vancouver, say, like, it's, you know, it's, you can't peg it on an individual, but if someone, you know, inherited a house in Vancouver and or Burnaby or whatever and sells it for over $1 million, then they can buy an acreage out here. And
they don't even have to put a new house on it. Like the place next to us here, which we actually have a lease on, it's got a house that's maybe worth $4 million, $3 million, the house itself. So, you know, it's actually a renovated farmhouse that now the property is literally worth $4 million, and it's smaller than ours.
We're coming close to the end of the show, and there's one thing I want to get in before we end today, and that is the idea of innovation and change. You have a grant proposal in for a solar array that could pretty much cover most of your electricity needs. How do you see that sort of shaping what you do as we go into the future? Just briefly.
Right. So just the assessors of our application, if you're listening, it would be really helpful.
I'm making them listen. So, I'm waving in their arms. They're going to listen.
So we applied for an agricultural clean technology grant, and we did just a walk around with someone from a solar energy company and identified one of our barn roofs that is at the perfect angle. And basically we would just like to cover that in solar panels.
But the real exciting thing is that's part of a 5-year grant opportunity for us that at any point, like if there's something we want to electrify, we can reapply for more funding. So I'm the first tractor that's available, you know, anything that's electric, we want it. Because like I was thinking about that today, like I do like to somewhat like micro industrialize some of our operations because that's how you make money in this economy. But I don't want to do it if there's no, you know, renewable energy option for that. So it's really exciting to me.
I can truly see the spirit that we talked about at the beginning of the show today is alive and well in not just one, but in multiple spheres in your minds. And I truly think that you, Steve, and Annalise are part of the process leading to not only better quality food, but to ultimately food sovereignty, which is what this show is all about, but it's also what I think community food growing consumption is all about as well. Thank you very much, Stephen Annalise, for your wonderful participation.
Can we provide our website?
Fresh Valley Farms. I know if you Google it, you'll find it right away.
Perfect. .ca, yeah. Organic meats in the Okanagan.
Thanks very much.
Lovely to have you.